Many people dream of owning a recreation vehicle and traveling the country enjoying the freedom RV ownership allows. In fact, nearly 9 million Americans already own RVs. To support them, there's a virtual army of businesses and professionals working behind the scenes. They are developing, building, selling, and supporting products that help people live their dream. There are also tens of thousands of people on the job at campgrounds and RV parks. They are working to ensure these travelers enjoy a fun, memorable time as they relax, connect with family or friends, and spend the night in their RVs and cabins. RV Industry News offers a behind-the-scenes look at the businesses and people that form the backbone of this important industry. This show also examines the critical issues they face and the decisions they must make to remain profitable and efficient. I'm Greg Gerber, the editor of RV Daily Report, and your host for this week's podcast episode of RV Industry News. Hello, everybody, and welcome to podcast episode number 24 of RV Industry News. It's a pleasure to have you back, and we have a great show for you planned today. We're going to talk to a couple of women who are actively involved in the RV industry. The first one is going to be Marcia Galvin. She is the head of human resources at Normandy Farms in Foxborough, Massachusetts. And she oversees a staff of about 128 workers, including teenagers and work campers. But she is also the chairman of the National Association of RV Parks and Campgrounds. So she's a pretty important bigwig within the camping industry. And it was a pleasure to have her on the show, but more of a pleasure to actually stay at her facility at Normandy Farms. What a spectacular campground. It's stretched out over about 100 acres of property. And it's been family-owned for generations, and they have just done a remarkable job in developing this campground up there in New England. They have traditional 50-amp campsites. In fact, every one of their RV sites is wired for 50-amp service, but they also rent cabins, RVs, yurts, lean-tos, and they're talking about building a treehouse for next year. To give people a variety of camping adventures. They are very, very pet friendly at that park and have in fact created a special dog park that they call Freedom Tail. And it allows dogs to run around quite a large area set aside for dogs to mingle, run, exercise, and just sort of stay out of the way of the campground, I guess. They also include a dog wash. So owners can wash off Fido before they take him back into the RV. But one thing, I have not seen this at any of the other campgrounds that I have visited. They even offer a dog watching service at Normandy Farms so that RVers can pay to have somebody come to the RV and take the dog on a quick walk a couple of times during the day. Or they even have kennels available so that people who are going to be out for an extended period of time might be able to put their dogs in a kennel and know that they are safe. The park also features an 18-hole disc golf course and a stocked pond for catch and release fishing. It's just a gorgeous facility. They have multiple pools at that RV park, and many of them are heated. They even have a ranger-attended bike park that was just packed when I got a tour of the facility as these guys were lined up waiting for their turn to run around the course. It's just absolutely spectacular, well-run, well-managed park. And she has some great ideas to help campground owners better manage their facilities. So I'm going to bring on Marcia Galvin. Welcome back, everybody. I have a great privilege here. I am at Normandy Farms Campground in Foxborough, Massachusetts. And I have with me in the RV studio the general manager of that organization. Is that what you are, Marcia?
Well, HR director.
HR director of the association. But Marcia is also the chairman, the current chairman of the National Association of RV Parks and Campgrounds. So it is a pleasure having you here, and she brought with her a guest, Jim Leeming, who is the chairman of the Massachusetts Association of Campground Owners and also the general manager of the Jellystone Park in Sturbridge. So thanks, guys, for coming over here.
Thank you.
Sure. I had the opportunity to spend the Labor Day weekend at Normandy Farms, and I guess, would you say zoo would be a good good description of all the activity? I mean, how many people were here, do you think?
Well, we have 400 campsites, so I think that, you know, everything was full, and, you know, I don't even know.
You don't even know, but it was thousands of people and thousands of kids, and they all cleared out, and it looks like a ghost town here on Tuesday, the day after Labor Day. So there was no shortage of activity in the campground. What are some of the favorite things that you folks offered that for kids and adults?
One of the biggest attractions is our Just Won It shirt events. So we design a new shirt every year, and the guests participate, kids, teens, and adults, to try to win the newest shirt.
The newest shirt.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So those are the definite big events. Then we try to introduce new things every year. We had an inflatable water slide this year. We added a third Halloween weekend. We try to plan our activities, too, when we theme our events, to do it midweek, so it attracts guests to come midweek rather than just on the weekends.
Excellent. So it's got something going on there and an incentive for them to either come early or stay late.
Exactly.
Just, that improves camper nights as well.
That's right.
But this campground is absolutely huge. There are how many sites?
About 400.
400 sites. Mm-hmm. And they have a pond for catch and release fishing. They have an 18-hole disc golf course here. They have three pools.
And then four.
Four pools, including one that's heated.
Two.
Two that are heated.
Yes.
Okay, very good. There's even an adult loft that so that parents and adults can escape and, I guess, support each other, right?
That's right.
But you even offer happy hour for the adults upon occasion.
Happy 2 hour.
Happy 2 hour. Very good. And what some of the other things that you guys have added in the last couple of years to improve your accommodations, I thought that was pretty interesting. You've got yurts, of course, but you also added or are looking to add a treehouse?
Yes. We're starting the preliminary work for that right now, surveying the land and checking, you know, the regulations and that kind of thing. We recently added the bike park, which was extremely popular with the kids, and the dog park as well.
Mm-hmm. And the bike park is a course that kids can ride around and go through jumps and over hoops, and what other kinds of things are they doing there?
It's more of an agility course, but we also have a bike park ranger.
So what other things are in the bike park?
It's more of an agility course for the kids, so they ride over the jumps, and they have a different terrain that they have to ride through, and there's a wall that they can, you know, try to go up on, and it's a lot of fun for the kids.
A lot of fun, right? But not right next door. You have a big dog park as well, a whole acre devoted to pooches that they can run off the leash. But I noticed that in the corner you have some kennels there. Why don't you explain that service that you provide?
Yeah, so we have some canine coops where guests, if they're traveling for the day, or even if they just want to spend the day at the pool, they can put their dog into a canine coop. It's all fenced in. It has a doghouse, a water spigot, and they're fully comfortable with leaving their dog in a comfortable area.
Mm-hmm. And for people who don't want to put their dog in a kennel for the day, you even offer a dog walking service, which I found unusual for a campground.
Right. So they can sign up at the office, and we'll walk their dog at any given time that they need to. And then, you know, we typically text them and tell them that they're, you know, dog's all set and they're back in their RV safe and sound.
So they know that doggy is taken care of, and that means that somebody's even checking the RV. So if something happened and the electricity went off and the air conditioning was turned off, then you'd be able to notify the parents, I guess, or owners of the dog that they can come back and take care of that problem.
Exactly. I mean, we find that our guests almost 100% travel with their dogs now. So they're just part of the family.
Mm-hmm. What other activities for adults and kids that you have here? I think I saw some shuffleboard.
Oh, yeah. We have all the traditional camping activities, shuffleboard, volleyball, softball, kickball, dodgeball. I think dodgeball is actually probably the most popular with the kids.
Is that what they were playing out there yesterday when we were getting a tour and they had this big giant ball that they were throwing at each other?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, super. And you hosted a big tournament this last weekend, a one-pitch softball tournament.
That's right.
So that means it's one or done. You're either on base or you're either got a hit or you're walking.
Exactly. So you're either out or you're on base. And we have guests that sign up days in advance for that. We have eight teams, double elimination. We hire two umpires that are certified in softball and two fields. And it came down to two teams this year. And actually, it was hard for me because my daughter was hosting one team and my husband was playing on the second team. So I had to cheer pretty much the whole time.
The whole time.
Yeah.
Who won? Which one?
My daughter.
Your daughter won. Awesome. That's great. One thing I noticed that you do here at Normandy Farms that many campgrounds don't is you have a restaurant or food service here, but you contract out that service. They're not employed here. What prompted that?
Well, we started off, it was a family member that ran the food service, and she decided that she didn't want to do that business, and nobody in the family pretty much had that expertise. So we decided that it was best probably to find, you know, an outside vendor that was good in that business. And we've tried several. We have a brand new one this year, which we found that the niche was that he provided seafood, which is sort of a New England fare that we have here. And he's done a great job. We built a whole new facility for them, brand new, everything. And they've done a great job. They provide twin lobster Friday nights and, you know, clam bake dinners on Saturday nights. And
That is unusual to go into a campground and see twin lobsters being made available for sale.
Exactly.
And it seemed to be pretty packed when I was over there the other night. Mm-hmm. And happened to have some fish, and that was pretty cool.
And but, on Happy 2 Hour, we do a raw bar. So we have oysters and shrimp cocktail that we provide too.
And does he provide that
he
as
does.
Well? Okay,
mm-hmm.
So any food service on the campground, you just orchestrate through them.
Yes.
Now, do you share in some of that profit, or is this just more of a convenience that's offered to your guests?
It's just more of a convenience. They lease the property from us, and they make the profit.
But do you indicate that they have to be open specific times and specific days?
And yes, and in fact, we ask that they participate in our training programs for our staff and wear certain attire. And so it sort of looks seamless to our guests that they don't know that it's an outside vendor that's providing that service.
I would agree it's seamless. I never would have guessed when I went over there to have dinner before we got their tour. That was, very, very interesting. And it's just not your typical campground fare of pizza and hot dogs and hamburgers and things like that. There is a whole menu of probably two or three dozen items that they can prepare back there.
Exactly. And the hot fried sundaes are incredible.
Mm-hmm. And none of these employees then that are working there are on your payroll.
No, they're not.
So it's all on they're responsible for that and maintaining all of the costs that are associated with that.
Exactly. And we also have our specific cleaning instructions that we want the building to look, you know, a specific way, and they work really well with us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's located right in the center of all of the activity there, right near their big clubhouse and three of their pools anyway, or what, and the center of the campground. So that's very good. You told me that this is the very first year that you offered seasonal rates to your campers, and you've been open for how many years?
Since 1971, and it's actually our second. I was corrected. It's our second year for seasonals. And the reason that we decided to do that was with 400 guests coming and going every weekend, it made sense to try to alleviate some of the traffic on Fridays and Sundays and start up a program where we're closed in the winter now. This will be our third season that we've closed. We were open year-round prior to that. And it just made more sense to, you know, try to allocate some of our sites to seasonals.
Sure, the roads over here in New England are relatively narrow, so driving an RV around is kind of a harrowing experience from time to time. So I can see with a campground that offers this many activities for kids that the parents would like to just park their RVs here and show up on the weekends.
Exactly.
Yeah, very good. How many seasonals do you have?
We have about a dozen.
About a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I know that some of the parks that I've stayed in, it's been completely opposite. They've only had 12 sites that are open for people coming through on the weekend, and the other 150, 200 of them are all seasonals. And so what kind of mix are you looking for?
You know, we have pretty strict guidelines for our seasonals. It's actually like a 5-page contract that they need to make sure that they adhere to. So I don't think we're looking for, a lot, because we can pretty much book the campground, as it is. So just, we'll just kind of play it by ear and see how the requests are.
Okay, very good. Does that help at all with the early season then, because you're getting some money up front for the seasonal campers?
Yeah, we have other programs too. We have a Spring Spectacular program where the guests can rent a site from April 1st through Memorial Day. So we have a spring seasonal program. We have our regular seasonal program. So we have different options for people.
Okay, very good. What do you attribute the success of the campground?
I think that probably the biggest success is that we have so many family members that work for us. When I was growing up, it was a farm. So I would collect the eggs from the chickens. I had a pet sheep that lived in my bedroom. So after that, we all sort of, and his name was Snowball, and he eventually disappeared, and we found out where he went, but that's why I don't like lamb. But, I'm the eighth generation. My children are the ninth generation. We all work here, and I think the success to the business is the dedication and the passion that we have for the industry. My children are, all doing their own thing, but they all work here as well. So I think that's probably the biggest.
A ninth generation business.
Mm-hmm.
That's just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And that must, many families find it difficult to live and work together. And you guys have pulled it off for 9 generations.
Yeah, it's not always easy.
Yeah, what do you do about that? I mean, how do you maintain your sanity in that kind of situation and prevent the family from exploding and blowing up?
Well, we all eat together. My parents and myself, our families live next door to each other. And in fact, the last 3 nights, we bring dinner over to my parents and we all cook together. And we don't talk about business all the time, which is probably a good thing. We talk about other things that are going on, the sports with the kids. And so we maintain that balance of work and family. And I think that's been a huge part of our success as working together.
Mm-hmm.
And also we've been working with transition companies, succession planners, so that, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, my dad doesn't want to, have his office in a ditch laying electric lines. He can take his motorhome to Florida and feel comfortable that everyone back at the park is, doing what they need to do and paying attention to detail like he does.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a trust that really plays into it.
Sure. And for conflict, then, if there's ever any source of disagreement, I guess addressing it right away is the key.
Oh, we have a family code of conduct, and it is 24 hours, that if there's any kind of conflict, that it has to be addressed within 24 hours.
So if somebody's got an issue and they don't bring it up within 24 hours, it's off limits then?
They can't do it.
They can't do it. Oh, that's a unique way.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes sure that they get it out, rather than festering on it,
mm-hmm,
and gossiping about it with other people. They've just got to bring it up and talk to it. And that's proven to be successful.
It definitely has.
Mm-hmm. Do you apply that to your family as well?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because we all work together. We're all family.
That's right. I had the opportunity to meet one of your sons. How many kids do you have?
I have 3.
3 of them.
Yes.
Okay. And they all work here at the campground?
They all do.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. How old are they?
They're 21, 15, and 16.
15 and 16.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. And which one did I meet the other day?
You met my youngest, 15.
The 15-year-old,
yes,
who claimed he was working under slave labor conditions. But, he looked really abused.
I brought him lunch.
You brought him lunch. That's right. Excellent. And so what are you guys doing to prepare these teenagers? Are they working different sections of the park?
They're actually working all in the same area. However, my oldest daughter is her senior year in college, and she's going to be a psychologist. So the biggest thing for us is to not force them into working in the family business. For myself, I worked part-time in the family business. I went on to be a teacher for 10 years, and I came back. My sister the same way. She went off to school for marketing, and then she came back. So the biggest part is to let them explore whatever they want to do. And hopefully we can keep it all together. And so if they want to come back, then it'll go on.
I think that's an excellent strategy. And I've heard a lot of RV dealers and campground owners employing that, because they get the kids out working for other people and corporations and in a little cubicle and slaving away. And while they're doing that, they're thinking, you know, I had a lot of fun there at that campground. It was hard work, but, you know, maybe I should come back and see what I could do.
Yeah, we actually make it a requirement now. They just can't come in. They need to go out and work for 2 years and then come back.
That sounds almost Amish, where they require the kids to go out on their own for a little while and then make sure that when they come back, they are committed to the, mm-hmm. the lifestyle. So mm-hmm. that's excellent. What a great idea. Now let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the state and national associations that you folks are involved in, and bring Jim back into the conversation, who has been waiting patiently here for an opportunity to speak. So let's start with the state association. Why don't you tell us what's going on there and how that's affecting campgrounds in Massachusetts?
Well, we have, I'm the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Association of Campground Owners, and Jim Leeming is my chairman, and we have a great board. They work really hard, and we have 70 campgrounds that belong to the association. We recently, over the last couple of years, have partnered with the Massachusetts Office of Travel and Tourism, worked some grants, gotten a lot more advertising out there for our state association. And so we rebranded ourselves to Camp Mass, and we're working along to keep camping in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest challenges facing campgrounds in Massachusetts?
I think it's not just Massachusetts, but I think it's probably generic. Small business, you know, in Massachusetts, they just raised our minimum wage. So it's going to go up $1 a year for the next 3 years. So
we're what level?
So it'll go up to $11 an hour.
Minimum wage. So you get a 15-year-old kid coming in here and you're paying him $11 an hour.
Exactly. So I think that's going to be a really big hurdle that small campgrounds are going to have to deal with.
Right. Wow. That would be very hard, I would think, for some. How many people do you guys employ?
Well, we employ 128.
But 128 people, so $1 an hour increase is a big expense that you guys are going to have to budget for. And when does that go into effect?
Well, it starts 2015.
So January 1. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
So, and that's going to be the bubble effect, you know. So you're going to start hiring people at, you know, a certain wage, but then you're going to have to raise the current
Absolutely,
staff.
Yeah, because the person who's been here a year isn't going to be wanting to make the same amount of money as the rookie right off the street.
Exactly. We figured our park is going to spend $53,000 every year just to
$53,000 just to cover the nut of the $1 increase
exactly.
in the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Wow. And you guys employ a lot of kids over there at Jellystone, don't you, Jim?
I guess we do. It's going to affect us too.
And so it impacts you as well with the increase in the costs?
Oh, certainly.
How many employees do you have?
We have about 75.
75. So that would be a big chunk of, well, it'd make a difference.
Well, certainly, especially over 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. What other issues are impacting the state, Jim, as far as campground owners are concerned?
We've got a bill that needs to be passed. It's been sitting in the state house since 2007.
Since 2007?
Yeah.
So for 7 years, they've been talking about a bill? What is this bill going to do?
Well, I'm going to let Marcia speak on that for a second.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's been a lot longer than 2007 that we've been fighting this issue, but parks have, we've been struggling with the DEP on septic issues. They don't really understand RVs, and we really need this one bill passed, which is, right now, they only allow one 10,000-gallon septic system on a piece of property owned by a family. So, for instance, you know, we own 100 acres, say, and Jim owns, you know, say 50 acres. Well, they only allow one 10,000-gallon septic system on each property if it's owned by one family. So, but if we were to sell our property off to condominiums, we could sell 101-acre lots, and then they would let each septic system be on each lot. So they just don't understand our industry.
Typical government. Mm-hmm. So how are you working around that? You can't have, do you have a 10,000 gallon septic system right now to service 400 campsites?
Yeah, we, you know, you have to work with the state. So we, right. We do.
Pumping it out every morning, exactly. Noon and night?
Yes.
I mean, my goodness, that would be a real challenge.
Yes.
Okay.
It is a real challenge. And, you know, we've gotten as far as talking with the DEP, but they just don't seem to want to work with us, it's with the campgrounds.
They don't. So are the legislators understanding the problem?
And they are.
They are. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they're sort of dragging their feet because it only probably impacts a couple hundred businesses as
exactly.
All. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Well, that sounds like a big challenge. Nationally, what kind of issues are there that campgrounds are facing?
Well, luckily we have a new program called StateNet, and our membership director, Jeff Sims, monitors every piece of legislation that comes through for each state, and he'll email us with, you know, things that we need to pay attention to. So, you know, I think for ARVIC, education, legislation, and marketing are the three main benefits that members have belonging to our association. As far as education goes, we're just planning our new conference for Vegas. This will be our third and final conference in Vegas, but there's over 50 seminars, a lot of new speakers. We conducted a study this summer for the outdoor enthusiasts to find out what brings people camping. And there's going to be a presentation there for that. Mm-hmm. Legislation, like I said, StateNet is huge and really beneficial to all our states. And marketing with Go Camping America and our partnership with RVIA. So I think ARVIC is doing a great job with all our member benefits as well, doing a great job trying to make it valuable for members to belong to ARVIC.
Right. Legislation, I think, would probably be a key. And then there's the strength in numbers as well, so that when a local entity might come after a campground, then you have an association that can come back and offer some credibility to the claims that or the issue that favors the campground.
Exactly. We have a legal defense fund where a state would put in a request for a campground that needs help. And actually, our state was a recipient of the legal defense fund and was able to help us, you know, form our bill. So there's disaster relief. So the National Association has a lot of benefits.
That's very true. You know, when you talk about disaster relief, it's probably another key reason why campgrounds should become a member of either their state or national associations, just because you never know when something's going to happen. You had an issue here a couple of years ago with a campground not too far away where a tornado just wiped it out, mm-hmm. came over the hill and completely demolished and leveled it. And the association was able to step in and provide some sort of assistance to them.
Yeah, we did a lot of fundraising. It was right next to Jim's Park, actually. Jim was spared from that. But Village Green did get totally wiped out. And unfortunately, there was a fatality. Mm-hmm. But our state association, and then it sort of went viral. Even the National Association helped in with individual campgrounds, and we were able to provide some assistance for them.
Right. And I probably wouldn't happen if they weren't members of the associations.
Exactly right.
Exactly right. Very good.
We actually got a new board member out of it, too.
Did you
yeah,
really?
We did.
Okay, super. Well, that's a good thing, because I would imagine that working, whether the state or national level, that finding enough volunteers to help fill all of those positions that you need and all to get all the work done has got to be a challenge.
It is. Trying to find volunteers to do anything in any association has become a challenge, and you know, our state association as well as ARVIC. So as I came on to chairman, one discussion that we had talked about in prior years was this book called Race for Relevance, and the board read it. And it's really talking about downsizing the board and making it more effective. And so this year we met at the past chairman's meeting in Tampa, and Dave Berg from Red Apple Campground, he's a love, he facilitated all the past chairmen from ARVIC to form, you know, a couple of committees and challenged us with, if you could start a new board, square one, for any organization, what would it look like? How would it be comprised? And both groups came up with similar construction ideas. And so what I asked our board to do, and I formed a special committee, and Dave Berg is actually the chairman of that committee, is to read the book, Race for Relevance, which they all got a copy. And coming up in this conference in Vegas, they're going to present the board with what their ideal structure of a board would be. So maybe it is smaller. Maybe it's designed a little bit differently. You know, a huge board, which we have 26 members, might not be the most reasonable amount of people. You know, what would a most effective board look like? So that's one thing that we're looking at for a recommendation for our board at Vegas. And the other one is we have a council of delegates, and it's always been represented by our affiliate states, two members from each state, and they would come together and they would talk about different issues. There was always a survey involved, and it's not always been the most valuable resource. So I've asked the governance committee, chaired by Michael Hobby, to look at the council of delegates, restructure it, maybe come up with some suggestions. Maybe we have every state, every 50 states represented by Arvik Parks, and you know, call it something different, maybe a Senate. And if we're going to restructure the board, maybe that would be the pool of people that we would look as to sort of be the funnel of where we get our new board members. So just some ideas of maybe looking at a different structure.
Okay. Would it be safe to assume that there's more work that could be done either on the state or federal or national associations if there were more people involved in the process?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And so that would make it enable people to do better planning and to be more proactive in addressing issues before they become real problems?
Exactly.
Okay. Very good. Very good. When you were talking about restructuring the board, would you be looking at restructuring the executive committees as well?
The executive committee is probably going to stay the same, I would think. I think, you know, maybe looking at now that we have a different due structure, where we changed our due structure last year, where we have small, you know, medium, large, and mega parks, maybe have a representative from each of those size parks as well as regions. You know, now we have six regions. Do we need six? How's the population in those six? Maybe we need to restructure the regions and have only one rep. I mean, there's a lot of things that this committee is going to look into to make sure that it encompasses, you know, every dynamic that, mm-hmm. you know, we would need.
And that's at the national level, with the national ARVIC.
Yep.
Okay. With the state association, though, Jim, volunteers, do you have any need for volunteers there?
Certainly.
Certainly.
We've got some issues now that we're, you know, putting committees together, and there's always plenty to do.
Always plenty to do, I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I've always found odd in our industry is the lack of cooperation between campgrounds and RV dealerships. In fact, when I will go into an area and I will talk to an RV dealer that I'm going to interview, I will say, can you recommend a campground that I could stay at? And many times it's they're trying to do a tap dance to figure out what campgrounds are in their area. And they assign it to a staff member who provides me with a list of Google campgrounds that they did some research on. So what can campgrounds do to help RV dealers? And what do you think dealers need to be doing to help campgrounds?
Well, I definitely think it's a partnership. And at our last annual meeting, we voted to change our bylaws. So we added a seat for the New England RV Dealers Association on our board, a non-voting seat. But we find that they are an integral part of our association. And if we don't partner together, then, you know, someone's buying an RV, like you said, where are they going to go? Mm-hmm. And, you know, personally, we host RV dealers in our park to set up displays. So we have a Good Sam rally coming up 2 weeks from now. We've got two different Camping World and McDonald's RV sales coming in to put up RVs so that, you know, our guests can go through. I definitely think there should be a stronger relationship and partnership between the campgrounds and the RV dealers.
I agree wholeheartedly. There's the folks in Pennsylvania right next door, they seem to have a really good system buttoned down so that the Campground Association was working with some of the top dealers in the state, and they worked out an arrangement where if you purchased an RV from one of those dealers, the dealer would give the buyer a coupon book for one free night of camping at all of these dozens of campgrounds, for the point of just getting people out there to tour the state and see what's out there and look at all of these different campgrounds. And then, of course, they'll select a couple that are their favorites that they'll keep returning to. But I think that kind of cooperation is really good.
We do a lot of camping shows, and at every camping show, we make sure that our mass guide is getting to all the dealers. So, and they'll call us when they need more. So, you know, just at least getting out the state directory so that when someone purchases a camper, they get a state directory.
Absolutely, it would be that simple. But still, RV shows, many dealers are out there selling RVs at these shows, but very often they're not bringing in any campgrounds or campground associations to talk about where to go to camp. I think that's just weird, to be honest.
We have a great show in Boston. Bob Zagami has done a fantastic job into integrating as many associations in New England as well as campgrounds. And, you know, I can just see that show growing and growing. Mm-hmm. Springfield is another great show. I was just in Springfield 2 weeks ago and saw Bob because they had a show at the Six Flags.
Right.
So, you know, I think the more that the campgrounds can get involved in the RV shows, the better it's going to be.
Absolutely, I think so. So where do you see the camping or outdoor hospitality industry 5 or 10 years from now?
I don't know. If I had a crystal ball, it'd be great. Mm-hmm. you know, I can only hope that it's going to continue to rise. We've seen with the economy, you know, being a little bit slow. Here personally, we've seen a lot more tenters, and tenters seem to gravitate towards rentals or, you know, upgrading their RVs. So a lot more younger families. So I'm looking at that as being a good sign for the industry where, you know, they're just going to keep continuing to camp because it's an affordable vacation where they can feel comfortable in their setting, sit by the campfire, not worry about, you know, the laundry or that kind of thing. Although, you know, we've had a lot more wireless devices, so our Wi-Fi has had to increase because everyone now has, you know, a device to be online.
At least one.
At least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If not two or three that they've got their laptop and their iPhones and their iPads and whatever else they've got, their Game Boys, everything seems to be communicating electronically.
Exactly. So I think that's going to be a huge, big influx in, you know, 5 years from now. It's going to be even more.
It's funny that you should mention tenters because when I was out taking pictures the other day, one of your campers stopped me to ask me if I was with a magazine, and I explained to him who I was and what I did, and he said, "This is the best park in all of New England." And he told me about how he worked for months to convince his wife to try camping. And so they got a tent and they went out here. He said it was 3 years ago and went camping for one weekend. And the next weekend, she went out and bought a trailer, actually a hybrid trailer. So with the pull down bunk beds, kind of the pull down tent side so that they could enjoy the outdoor tenting experience, but still have the full kitchen and a bathroom, which she really wanted. So that's really neat. And I did see a lot of campers in tents here today or this weekend. And I know that's been a hot button issue for Jim Rogers over at KOA, who talked about the millions of people who are using campgrounds. I know that's been a hot button issue for Jim Rogers over at KOA, who talks about the millions and millions of people who go camping every year, but they do it in tents. So it's a great opportunity for the RV industry, but even for private campgrounds. I mean, one thing that I do notice or do want to ask you about is the competition between public and private campgrounds. I mean, do you find that that's a sore subject in your state or at the national level, or do you think the campgrounds are cooperating?
Well, I can speak for our state. You know, we don't have any issues with the public and private parks in our state. We, in fact, I was on a committee with the public campgrounds to look at the trend for camping. So they welcome, you know, our input as well as, you know, we value what they have. It is sort of a hot button in other states as far as national goes. So pretty much national just allows the states to do their own thing, you know, in their states because some welcome them, some don't. There's you know, a conflict of interest some places and there's not in others. So mm-hmm. we sort of just let them deal with it at a state
level. Let them do it at the yeah. state level. And I guess they all provide some sort of a service to the campers and to families. Mm-hmm. You know, the state parks are in some of the prettiest recreation areas, et cetera. But mm-hmm. the private independent parks also play a role because they provide more amenities than the state parks, mm-hmm. including electricity and water and septic systems and things like that. So that's...
You know, there's a park out there for everyone. So it really depends on what you're looking for. You know, you could go to a state park or you could go to a resort. And, you know, you're going to get different campers in different places. So.
And different experiences. Mm-hmm. And it all... And that's what makes the industry so good.
That's right.
So, well, thank you very much. I know we've been talking for a long time. I really thank you for coming on the show. And best of luck to you in the future as you bring in more campers.
Well, thank you for visiting us.
Absolutely. To be totally honest, I have no idea how Marcia finds any time to devote to the National Association of RV Parks and Campgrounds, let alone serve as its chairman. With all the activity that she has to manage over there at Normandy Farms, it's truly spectacular. How she is able to get it all done and still have time to devote to the industry. So I'm very appreciative for her to take some time out of her day to come in. In fact, this interview is recorded on Labor Day weekend. So for her to do that on one of the busiest weekends of the year was very impressive, to say the least. My next guest is Linda Mailhot. She is the co-owner of Seacoast RV in Saco, Maine. Now, during the interview, I pronounced it Seiko multiple times, and she corrected me a couple of times, and we restarted the interview, but when I pronounced it as Seiko again, I just figured I was too ignorant to learn, but it is Saco, Maine, and they've been up there for quite a few years. They run a full-service RV dealership, but they also have a pretty impressive mobile service operation, and they are sending several trucks every day out to campgrounds throughout the New England area. And there's a reason for that. They are a big dealership into park models, and they are probably the number one park model dealership in all of America. And that's pretty impressive when you think that they are operating up there in Maine, which has a very short season, and there are far more park models sold down in Texas, Arizona, and Florida, but they are the number one park model dealership in the country. And she's got some working with her husband Mike, who pretty much handles service. They've developed some pretty strong relationships with campgrounds, and they need to because the season is so short up there. But she has some great ideas on what RV dealers can do to develop their relationships with the campgrounds and why the park model industry is a good thing for dealers to be in. So let me switch over and bring on Linda. Welcome back, everybody. I am on location in Saco, Maine, talking with Linda Mailhot, who is the owner of Seacoast RVs. Welcome aboard, Linda.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
We had the opportunity to come up here and talk to her. She was recommended by Bob Zagami for the quality of the business that they operate. And Seacoast RVs has been in business for how long?
20 years this year.
20 years. Well, happy anniversary. And I understand that you got started not by selling RVs, but by fixing them. Why don't you tell us how you got into the business?
Sure. My husband, Mike, actually started the business 20 years ago as a mobile repair business. And we continue to do that to this day, actually.
So you started fixing the RVs before you sold them. And then what caused you to bring the RV lines on?
Well, as our business grew and we had a loyal succession of customers, people were asking us for sales. They said, you know, geez, it's great that you service our RV, and wouldn't it be fabulous if we could buy one from you as well?
Very good. And so you've been selling them for how long?
Since 1996, as far as used goes, and I believe new in 1998.
And you primarily specialize in park models. And so the park model manufacturers you work with are?
Croft Industries.
crops. That's the pretty much the biggest one. Okay. And then you also take inventory for new RVs from, what did you say?
Skyline, Starcraft, and Dutchman for new travel trailers.
The big ones. Okay. Very good. And so by starting in service, you continue that today. I know when you were giving me a tour, we saw approximately 3 trucks out there. Most of your work then is done off-site?
Most of our service work is done off-site. As I mentioned, we started as a mobile repair company. We continue that to this day, and it works out very well for us.
And it would have to be if you were servicing a lot of people who own destination trailers and park models that can't bring those babies in for service. So that's neat. How many technicians do you employ?
We have 3 full-time service technicians, including my husband, Mike. He's out on the road every day doing repairs. He loves it.
Every day. Very good. And one thing that you had mentioned that was unusual about the business was your relationship with the campgrounds. The season starts relatively late up here in May, and it continues until early October. So that is a very short season. And you work, because you sell the park models and destination trailers, you work with the campground owners. How do you maintain those relationships?
Well, you know, I'm really a relationships kind of a gal. I believe in relationships. I think it's the foundation of your business. It's how you interact with your customers. And naturally, of course, that carries over to suppliers, to vendors, to campground owners in the area. We can give out referrals. And it also just helps if everyone works together in this industry, particularly in a very seasonal industry like we have up here in our great state of Maine.
And the campground owners are willing to bend the rules a little bit to help you, and it's because of that relationship. So even though the campgrounds might not open until May, you are often able to get into the campgrounds in April to set up new RVs and new travel trailers and park models for folks?
We are, and we're very appreciative of that, as well as our mutual customers. And, you know, in the same token, if the campgrounds need something, they'll call us, and if we can go over there and be of assistance to them or try and help them on the phone, we're more than happy to do that.
Now, many RV dealers ignore the park model segment of the industry, and if they do sell into it, they have maybe 1 or 2 units on their lot that they use to show off and then take orders. How many units do you folks stock normally?
I would say on the low side, we're usually about 12 park models, and then on the high side, we're usually around 50.
50. And you said most of those come in the winter. Is that a problem for storage and things like that?
We learn how to deal with the snow. It's something that we have to deal with here in the Northeast and New England. And it's just another day, another snowflake. We know how to deal with it.
Just another day. Now, you do pave the lot, so that makes it easier to keep the snow off, I'm sure. But yeah, so all of these park models are coming in and throughout the winter. And then do you have to do a lot of PDI inspections and work on them when they come here? The park model manufacturers pretty much got that buttoned down.
Croft Industries does a terrific job at that. They have a final finish line where they have people in their own plant go through them and make sure that they're ready to go. So it's minimal prep time when they get here, but there is a little bit, sure.
Now, most of the customers that come here, you said, are from Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire, a couple of people from Maine who live up here, maybe a few from New York. Do you have a heavy internet business?
The internet is a fabulous tool for people to preview inventory and to sort of start a dialogue, if you will, about what we have available, what the options and possibilities are. But it really takes a back seat to people who can come here and realize that they can see a couple dozen park models at any given time.
Absolutely. The ability to walk through the park models. Do you see that helps in the sales process?
Oh, absolutely.
Super, because the people get to walk through and they can envision how it looks and what they can do with it. Now, most of your customers, are they retired folks or are they families?
You know, there's a very good mixture. I would say that it's probably a majority of retired couples, but there are a lot of families who are doing this where, you know, mom and dad leave work on a Friday afternoon, pack up the kids, get in the car, get to their campground, put the key in their park model or their destination travel trailer, and everything's in it already. You know, all their clothes, all their food. There's a lot of convenience to be said for that.
Absolutely. And the kids, the models with the kids, are those usually the loft models?
Usually the loft models, yes. We have also, though, some 2 and 3 bedroom park model trailers here that we do very well with.
Well, I've never seen a 2 or 3 bedroom park model, so we might have to go outside and take a peek at that, because usually it's 1 big bedroom and then an open area upstairs, but they're 2 to 3 bedroom models. Very cool. And what do these normally retail for?
Anywhere from around $43,000 to around $65,000, depending upon options.
Okay, so comparable to a good high-end travel trailer or fifth wheel.
Yes, and if you're not traveling, it has all the comforts of home and then some. They have a lot more space in them.
Now, is that a big benefit then, I would think, for this area? Because what I've noticed driving through here is there's not a lot of space between the homes, and not a lot of space certainly on the street to be parking RVs. So having a destination trailer sounds like it'd be a big advantage.
It is, if your lifestyle is at the point where you want to go to the same place every weekend or every week, or if you're in the point of your life where you're maybe doing 6 months up here in the New England states and six months elsewhere, such as the South Carolinas, the Carolinas, or Florida. But just depends on where you are and what stage in your life.
Okay, very good. But a lot of families are embracing the lifestyle up here and are looking at park models too. So would you say that these are families with young kids or mostly teenagers?
Again, it's a little bit of a mixture, but I would say maybe a little bit more on the teenager side.
The teen side, because we notice that the average age of RV ownership, I think, has fallen from what used to be 55, and it's down now into the upper 40s. Are you seeing that pretty much too?
Yes, for sure. I would say that on the lower end, our customers, as far as age-wise goes, usually start around 43, 44, 45.
Okay, and that's for park models or the travel trailers, correct?
Yes, for both, certainly.
Okay, very good. Now, one thing that you do to help your customers or to show your appreciation to them is you plan this big event in the springtime after they come back and after the campgrounds are open. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, we have a big annual customer appreciation days and open house event that we do in May. I know a lot of dealers like to do open house events in the off season in the winter, but since ours is really more of a customer appreciation event and we're offering them discounts and in other ways that we can show our appreciation to them, I think it's important to wait until they're mostly around and thinking about camping.
And do you have a big part of the celebration? What kinds of things do you offer? You have special food? Do you bring in bouncies, things like that?
Oh, yes. We feed them for free all the time. We are giving them free merchandise. We're giving them major discounts in the store and just doing anything that we can to show them that welcome back for the season and we appreciate your business.
So even though it's in May and it's part of the season is here, it's not a problem for you to sell RVs during that time because you stock so many of them throughout the winter. You said you bring in how many?
We bring in about 50 park models in the wintertime, so we really stock up and sell off of that inventory into the spring. It works well for us.
Okay, so by the time they come to the customer appreciation event, you still have this inventory on stock. They can come in, look it over, and you can, because you have the inventory on stock, you can get them set up and ready in a couple of weeks?
We can. May is getting a little bit late for that. We sell off a lot of our inventory in the winter, really. So if someone's waiting until May, it's a little bit on the end of the stick, but we can make it happen for sure.
You can make it happen, but having that much inventory on hand helps a lot because you said the delivery time to get them up here is significant if you don't have an RV in stock.
Anywhere from 8 to 15 weeks. Yes, that's a long time.
15 weeks would probably be a season buster for somebody, so they'd be ordering something to come in over the winter and be ready for the following year.
Yes, and we're actually doing a lot of that right now even.
Another aspect or profit center of your business is this giant parts store that you have here. And that probably came out of the repair business where you had to have a lot of parts for everything that's out there. And you said that you have about 10,000 or thousands and thousands of parts. We really don't know for sure, but Coast is your distributor. Why did you select Coast?
Again, I'm more of a relationships kind of a gal. It helps certainly that Coast has an outside salesperson that is located in our area right here in our great state of Maine. And we've developed a relationship with them over the years, and they've been there when we've needed them. And we're happy to continue that now. So it's been a great partnership.
Very good. A lot of dealers up here are reporting challenges that they have in interacting with the government. There's too many regulations and inspections and things like that. Have you found that to be true up in Maine?
I think it's true everywhere, yes. So, yeah, there are rules and regulations that certainly make things challenging and I'll say interesting, but it's just something that needs to be dealt with, and you have to be patient and know what you're doing and follow the rules, and eventually it will come.
So is your market area just generally around here in the Old Orchard, Saco area of Maine, or do you go to the other states as well?
We do go into other New England states as far as delivering park models down as far as Rhode Island, actually.
Wow. Do you service them that far away as well?
We do. We service everything that we sell, and I think that's been very important for our business and for our success. And as we mentioned, we started as a repair company and have just realized that that is one of the things that makes us unique. That's our background, customer service, repairs in a timely manner. And by doing that all ourselves, we can control that and are sure that we can deliver the best customer service possible.
Now, when you're having to send a technician a couple of hours away down to Rhode Island, do the customers have to pay a special service charge to get down there?
Never. Nope, that's part of the sale.
Really? So if they need something happens with their toilet, you're sending a technician down and you're incurring the costs to pay him to get down there for the mileage, et cetera, and then the technician or the customer is only paying for whatever needs to be fixed once he gets there?
Well, if it's a warranty issue, we are absolutely going out with no charge to the customer. We don't believe in charging a service call. Most RV dealers do charge a service call for working on destination trailers or park models, but for us, that's part of our business, and we sold that, and we knew that when we were selling that customer that trailer, and it's important to keep that up, and it helps with referrals and in word of mouth, and it's been a good business strategy for us.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that pose some problems for scheduling? So when people come in for service, you try and get people organized in a specific area, so on Tuesday we're in this area, on Thursday we're in this area, or does it just when they call in, you get out?
No, we do schedule things geographically so that we're making the best of our time. My husband, Mike, does most of the away, the long-distance service calls, and keeps all of that running well and very convenient and minimizing the cost on that. But it's worked well for us, and it's been great that we've had our relationship with Croft Industries, so they've respected that with us through the years.
Now, are the technicians you work with, do you provide any education, or do you hire just certified technicians?
It's hard in our great state of Maine to find people that have experience in the RV industry. And when my husband first started, he was working for another competitive RV dealer back when he was in high school. And if you have the mechanical aptitude and the skills and let's just say plain old common sense today, then you can really learn this business. It doesn't necessarily have to be through a formal education process at a university or a school. But, so it's a little bit of a challenge, but we've got some great guys working for us, and we're appreciative of that.
Now, do you employ them all year round, even during the off season? How do you keep them busy?
We do employ them year round. We don't lay off any personnel. We keep everyone on staff. We think of our employees as part of our family, really. You know, we take care of them. We provide everyone with health insurance and full benefits. And we believe that if we're good to them, they'll be good to us.
Wow. So even if things slow way, way down in the winter, everybody's still on the payroll.
They are. And actually, our service shop is busy 12 months of the year. So when we're going gangbusters doing mobile repairs in the middle of the summer, we're also putting together a backlog of winter work that we can do in the service shop. Things like big insurance jobs, roof replacements, and whatnot. So we're definitely not slow in the wintertime, maybe just on the sales side.
Does that mean you offer some storage here during the winter?
We really don't, because honestly, we don't have the room to offer storage. But we do bring service jobs back from the campgrounds and keep those here and work on those in the winter and then deliver those again in the spring.
Makes sense to keep everybody busy. Now, you said that you are going to the first RVDA convention that you've been to in years this year. Why is that?
Well, first, it's being held in November. It was always held earlier in the season. I think it was sometime in September. And even though we're in Maine, we're still busy here in camping season in September. And it never really made sense to me why some of these industry shows were held during the busy time. We just couldn't get there.
So you're heading over there. Are you planning to take advantage of any of the educational offerings that are there? Are you just going to hang out and see what's new?
No, we're going to go out and see what's new and listen to what some of the educational seminars have to say. You can always learn. I learn things every day, and it's one of the great parts and pieces of this business.
Very good. You were telling me yesterday that you had a little blip take place in the business, and that some company a couple of miles away had some sort of tech construction mishap, and it sent a surge of electricity all the way through the lines and impacted your business?
Yes, it did. We went from high tech to low tech in a matter of minutes when there was an incident at a machine down the street at a neighboring business, and somehow it backfed into our computers and we lost some equipment. We were down a little bit yesterday, but my motto is always be prepared. So we got out the old-fashioned paper and pen and the carbonless credit card slips, and we made it happen.
That's kind of a good reminder to everybody, RV dealers and campgrounds as well, that are so dependent on technology now that you have to have that backup in place. And you've always had that?
Yes. As I say, machines are wonderful, but they're only wonderful when they work. So be prepared for when they don't.
Excellent. And how long you've been in business for 20 years. Where do you see the market going in the Maine area in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think there will be an increase in destination camping and park models, which is why park models, particularly our partnership with Croft Industries, has been important to us since we started new sales in 1998. Our first RV that we ever sold was a Croft park model. And just taking a step back and looking at how we've both progressed through those years through a great partnership together, I see that that only continues and flourishes. And people will see that destination camping in park models are a big part of what happens in the RV industry. And it also opens up the RV industry to people who traditionally don't think of camping or RVing.
Because they just prefer to drive up there, park in front of their wherever they're going to hang out, their cabin, et cetera. So this is a great alternative to these lake cabins, et cetera, that are out there. Is that what you're saying?
It is, and at a much lower price point. Because if you can have a seasonal site in a campground for anywhere from $2,500 to $6,000 for the year, and then to buy a park model for $43,000 or $45,000, and it comes fully furnished and appliances, that's a lot lower of an investment than it is for a piece of real estate, not to mention you don't have the same types of real estate taxes and maintenance expenses that you would of a standalone property.
So as far as the RV industry is concerned, you see that there's good times ahead, no warning signs or anything like that?
I don't see any warning signs ahead right now, but one of the things that we've always believed in is been being lean and mean. We keep our dealership at a manageable size. We could certainly expand and do some more things with it, pick up other product lines, other types of RVs, such as motorized. But for us, that's just not the way that we've chosen to go based on mine and my husband's upbringing.
So the managed growth has really helped you a little bit in keeping the costs down and maintaining that relationship with customers?
Managed growth, in my opinion, has been one of the main reasons that we've been able to stay successful throughout our 20 years, including the blips that you see on the RV radar from time to time. We keep it at a manageable size. with barely, I would say fairly minimal staff for what we need to get through the season. But that helps us to make sure that we're not growing too fast and become subject to some of those things like the economy turning in 2008, 2009.
Have you ever considered expanding into these other neighboring states?
No. Again, for us, it's about managed growth. It's about running a good family-owned business as well as you can. It's not about how much money we could make. It's not about how big we could be. It's about making a decent living for ourselves and our families and our employees and going to bed every night knowing that we're doing the right thing for ourselves and our customers.
Sure. Now, because of the managed growth and you're taking it slow and you're getting to know your customers, are you seeing a lot of repeat business because of that?
Yes, and it makes me very happy. A lot of our customers become friends over the years, and it's one of the great things of, I still work at the front counter every day. I still answer the phones every day just to keep tabs with what's going on and talking to everyone. And again, as a relationships kind of a gal, that's big for me.
That's very good. So they come in, people come in even asking for you. Now that you've been around for 20 years, I bet you're starting to see some of your customers' children showing up.
Oh, yes. And that's great. You know, I love it when that happens. And, you know, I usually remember their names and what campground they're in and what they have for an RV. And it makes it special.
Very good. You said that one of the neat things about the lot here in Saco is that they've got a big trail right behind the dealership. And how big is this trail?
It's part of the Appalachian Trail. It's actually called the Eastern Trail, and it's a series of trails that go up and feed into the Appalachian Mountains, which run from Maine down south into Georgia, I believe. And it's a big recreational tool that people use around here. You look outside at any point in time and you'll see people biking and walking and hiking. It's a great natural resource.
So not only do you get the traffic visibility from the highway in front of the dealership, but you get the traffic from the trail behind it.
We do, and it's funny. We have a lot of people that come in on bikes from the trail or walking and said, you know, we were just on the trail and we saw all the RVs out back and we thought, oh my gosh, let's go take a look at them, or it reminded me that I needed something and I didn't necessarily know that you were here as I'm passing through.
Very good. Well, it sounds like you've got a really good button-down business here, lots of success under your belt, and you're predicting blue skies in the future. So I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Certainly. Pleasure having you here. Thank you.
Well, that'll wrap it up for podcast episode number 24 of RV Industry News. I'm so glad you took the time to join us. It's been a busy couple of weeks with the Pennsylvania RV Show and the Elkhart Open House. We have maybe 8 or 9 interviews left to go that we need to bring out here as podcast episodes. And some of the ones that we've recorded have been absolutely phenomenal. It'll be a great discussion builder in our RV industry. And I think that you will find what these folks have to say to be very, very worth your time. So I will. Tomorrow I'm heading off to Phoenix again. My daughter is getting married in about a week, so I've got to go back home and take care of some business things and also gear up for the big wedding. That'll mean everybody is off the payroll, so that'll be nice. But we will be back here within a couple of days, and I hope to have a few more podcasts out next week. And so look for those, and I hope you have a great weekend. Thank you.